Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Not quite sure what that bird was on my music there, but anyway, this is Richard Martin with your Monday rendering of the wake-up call on September the 24th, 2012. And yes, my friends, I've got one more comment to make by way of a kind of recap to what I've been talking about recently concerning the damnable quantitative easing. And what I'm going to do today is to rehash some of the toxic things that QE3 will do to the system. You really do need to know in some detail not only why QE3 will not work, but also what it does achieve that is so very injurious to the economy. I guess there are five areas of negative effect that come about when you pour unneeded and unwanted money into an economy. Let's have a look at them one by one. And before we start, understand well that QE3 reverses none of what ails the economy. It doesn't reduce hiring costs. It doesn't contribute to liquidating bad investments and inspiring the development of solid new ones. It doesn't reward the sacrifice of current consumption for future investment that is necessary for the building of future prosperity. All it does is to drain economic energy. It only means more bleeding of the patient. So first of all, QE3 kills the traditional institution of saving for a generation. It used to be that responsible people would save money, putting it in banks to earn interest. The earned interest was the reward for forestalling current consumption. But low interest rates inhibit your ability to grow your savings. Blame the central banks. Bernanke is the one controlling this system, driving interest rates to zero precisely to punish your saving and cause you to splurge in the hopes that this will somehow fire up economic growth. Remember how George Bush urged Americans to go out and spend money after September the 11th? This, he said, was the best way for average Americans to show the terrorists a thing or two. All these years later, this anti-saving mentality has been the prevailing ideology. The results, of course, have been an abysmal failure. All right, well, secondly, QE3 will drive money to financial innovations that make money for insiders but are forbidden to the rest of the public. New money has to go somewhere. It typically chases the most fashionable investments. Traditional savings or dividends are certainly not fashionable. What is fashionable is high-speed program trading managed by large institutions. Does no one remember that this is how the housing boom was created in the first place? Institutions bundled mortgages into marketable packages that glossed over critical questions of risk. It was as if risk didn't exist. Everyone figured that the federal government would come to the rescue should anything happen. Mostly, people assumed that nothing would happen. Then, the whole system blew up. Regrets were all around. For a while, the elites must have decided that the whole system wasn't so bad after all, so they attempted to patch it up. QE3 represents an attempt to recreate the bubble economy in the financial sector. Rinse, repeat. The third area of negative effect is where QE3 will keep borrowing costs of the federal government at artificially low levels. Ever wonder why Congress and the President act as if economic law doesn't exist? They used to worry about the cost of borrowing, but now that's driven to zero. The Fed has provided mad spending politicians the greatest subsidy they've ever had. They can run deficits and debts as high as Mars and not worry about the results. QE3 rewards this outlook yet again. So don't look for austerity here anytime soon. The chains have been loosened. They will continue their spending rampage. And the longer it continues, the higher the stakes. Interest rates must remain low forever, for even the slightest uptick will blow budget projections to smithereens. This is how the Fed gets the rest of the government invested in its moral corruptions. Fourthly, QE3 will do nothing to reduce unemployment for those who are most affected by it. The new money will cause boomlets and some hiring, but not among the young, who are now at the point of despair. And just look what must have been my 20th phone call from a smart 20-something who is out of work, living at home, despairing for his future prospects, lost and confused, and thinking terrible thoughts. He wanted to know whether Bernanke's action would help him. Tragically, the answer is no. And finally, if ever the banks do decide to spend all this money, and only if, QE3 will bring inflation. Maybe it will bring hyperinflation, but that only happens if the banks start using their phoned up balance sheets as the basis for new money expansion. But why would they do this? It's just not in their interest, so long as the payout rate is near zero. All right, well, we'll let that one gestate for a while. And let's go back to what I talked about on my very first show here on PRN years ago. I discussed the meaning and origin of money, and I have referred to it several times since. So today, I'm going to talk about how it has been horribly and unrecognizably perverted over the last 30 or 40 years with the full connivance of the banks. And I thought we'd start with the famous cartoon characters talking about what money is.
Ed, how much money do you have in your wallet?
I don't know, maybe about $50. Why?
Where did it come from?
I earned it.
That's not what I mean. I mean, where did the money come from originally?
I guess from banks.
No, that would mean you borrowed it. You said you earned it.
It came from the government?
Right. Where did the government get it?
They issued it based on the amount of gold we have in Fort Knox.
No. We haven't been on the gold standard since 1971. There is no gold backing the US dollar.
You mean the dollar isn't backed by anything?
Not exactly. But let me ask you again. Where does the government get its money?
They print it?
Right. So if they print the money, how does it get to your wallet?
I don't know. I guess through banks.
No. If you got your money through the bank, you borrowed it. We already covered that.
Well, how then?
The government spends the money into the economy. Every time the government buys something from private businesses, or pays government workers' wages, it is spending money into the economy.
Yeah, but I earned the money in my wallet. It didn't come from the government.
Where did it come from then?
From whoever I worked for.
Where did they get it?
From whoever they earned it from.
Now we're going in circles. Money had to exist before anyone could earn it. Where did it come from?
From the government.
Okay, so you agree that before anyone had any money, the government had to create and spend it first?
I guess so.
So every year the government spends into the economy a budgeted amount, and at the end of the year it taxes money back out. If taxes are less than spending, we would have a budget deficit. If it taxes more, we would have a surplus.
But we do have budget deficits. That's what's wrong with the economy now.
So budget deficits are bad?
Yes.
Why are they bad?
Because then we have to borrow money to pay for the deficit, and then the government has to raise taxes to pay the money back.
The government creates the money. Why would it borrow back money it previously created? Wouldn't it make more sense to just print more money?
No. That would cause inflation.
Why would that cause inflation?
Because there would be too much money in the economy. That would make money worth less, so we would have inflation.
Maybe. But if the government didn't spend more money into the economy than it taxed out, there would be no money in the economy other than money borrowed from banks. How would you get the money that's in your wallet, borrow it? And how would that cause inflation?
Good question. This is making my head hurt. I don't know.
Yeah, learning simple things can be hard. So you can see why deficit spending is required for the economy to grow.
I guess so. But we have to borrow to pay for the deficit, and the borrowing is killing the economy.
We are going in circles again. The government doesn't have to borrow, it is the creator of the money. It creates money at will out of thin air as needed. It does not necessarily lead to inflation. That depends on how much spending there is in comparison to available goods and services.
Then why does the government borrow money to pay for the deficit?
The government doesn't borrow money to pay for the deficit. It issues matching treasuries against excess savings to comply with a law passed in another era when the country was on the gold standard.
Then how does the government pay for the deficit?
It doesn't pay for the deficit. It creates new money out of thin air and spends it into the economy.
But that will cause inflation.
We already talked about that earlier. The new money matches population growth and increasing profits earned from selling goods and services in the economy. This is not cause for inflation.
What about the money we owe China?
We don't owe China money. We owe China the goods that money can buy, but China doesn't care to buy them right now. China earned dollars by selling us more stuff than we sold them.
But everyone says we owe China lots of money.
Don't believe what everyone says. China doesn't have enough mattresses to store all of the money they have earned from selling us flat-screen TVs, so they buy treasuries instead for safekeeping.
Okay, but how about the national debt?
What about it?
Don't we have to pay it back by raising taxes?
If we paid it back through taxes, there would be no money left in the economy other than money borrowed from banks. The money in your wallet would not actually be yours.
You're making my head hurt again.
Thinking is hard. That's why we rarely do it.
So what is the national debt?
The national debt is the amount of money to the penny that the federal government has spent into the economy since it began creating dollars. Without it, there would be no net private savings. Today, the national debt includes all of the dollars held by the public, plus all of the dollars held by foreign companies that have done business with the U.S., except for a small amount surviving from rare periods in U.S. history when the federal government created money without borrowing. Paying off the national debt by taxing more than we are spending is impossible without collapsing the economy, and it makes no logical sense to think of the national debt in the way we have been taught. State governments have constraints in paying back their debts, because their supply of money is limited to what they can tax or borrow. The federal government not only can create money, it is the monopoly creator of the money, and can always either roll over any debts it incurs, or if it wants to, completely pay off the debt with money it creates without borrowing any more. So what kind of debt is it that one can pay by making more money at will? It's an accounting entry, the entry point for new money into the system that must exist if there is to be sustainable growth and net savings in the economy. It's not a debt that needs to be repaid, ever.
Okay. Well, think about this. The original idea behind banks gathering reserves, was in the 19th century, where they would make productive loans to finance industry. That was the point of banks. And the aim was for banks to do something new that no economy had done in the past. Make loans not merely to ship and market goods once they were produced, but to finance new capital investment by manufacturers and producers, as well as by the public sector, to build infrastructure. The idea was for these investments to create profits out of which to pay the interest and the principal back to the lenders. This was defined as productive lending. Nothing like it occurred in antiquity or in the post-feudal period. Investment always had been self-financed out of savings. Banks had previously only entered the picture when it came to shipping and trading what had been produced. Now, since the beginning of the time when manufacturing all but died in the U.S., banks have allied themselves with real estate. So instead of getting a share of the profits, it has focused on lending against unearned income. Now, unearned income has no counterpart in the cost of putting means of production in place. And land has no cost. It's provided by nature. The only cost is the price of buying the right to charge rent on it. This rent, or unearned income, is created by special, artificial legal privilege or ownership rights. For example, to install toll booths on roads, education systems, and other basic needs. Owners aim to charge as they can, but without regard for how this affects overall growth and balance. Banks have the privilege of creating credit and charging for access to it. Most bank credit is extended to buy property or rent-seeking privileges already in place. Banks are rarely set up to evaluate new capital investment. Their time frame is notoriously short-term. It takes time to develop production facilities, mount a sales campaign, and develop markets for new goods. It is easier simply to buy a privilege to extract charges without producing anything at all. This is what property rights are, along with special privileges such as charging interest without making a tangible investment. So banks back the kind of economy that makes money without new capital investment. The easiest way to do this is to make loans for real estate at increasingly debt-leveraged bank-inflated prices. They call this a post-industrial service economy to make it sound respectable, like quantitative easing for money printing. And they like to think it validates the gambling nature of what they do now. About 80% of current banking activity is involved with just this. Rental income from this real estate fiasco is used to pay interest to banks rather than taxes to the state. Banks no longer make loans for what can be produced in the future. They make loans against collateral already in place, including entire companies with high-interest junk bonds. The target company is obliged to pay the debt that the corporate raider takes on. The raider then is free to downsize and outsource the workforce, squeeze the budget, and hope to come out with a capital gain after paying off the banks and bondholders. The process is extractive rather than productive. Stock markets were supposed to supply equity investment capital, but they have been turned into a vehicle for debt-financed leveraged buyouts, or LBOs. Raiders borrow money much like landlords borrow to buy a rental property and bleed it. This turns corporate cash flow into interest. Governments permit this to be tax deductible, so this encouragement of debt financing over equity worsens their fiscal position. It forces them into debt to bondholders. So the process becomes a deteriorating financial spiral. This has led the banks to go down a long, dark hole of fraudulent activity. Now, I'm not going to go into detail here about the nature of that fraud. Suffice it to say that nearly every large Wall Street bank has paid large sums of money to settle criminal fraud cases with the U.S. legal authorities without admitting criminal liability for their huge gains. So, no banker has gone to jail. The banks have paid the fines, not the managers, who have paid themselves enormous salaries, bonuses, and stock options for writing junk mortgages and operating in a manner that would have sent them to jail back in the 1980s. That's when the SNL fraudsters were sent to jail for doing what commercial bankers much higher up on the social pyramid have done over the past decade. The top executives know that if they're convicted of billions of dollars of fraud, their banks will pay a fraction of this amount, not themselves. They know that the jig is nearly up, so they're giving themselves enormous bonuses and running. The Treasury argues that if it fines the banks to recover the full amount of the fraud, they'll be driven under, and the government will have to bail them out. In effect, it would be paying the fine to itself. So it does nothing except receive more campaign contributions from Wall Street for being so passive. You see, they used the 2008 aftermath as an opportunity to panic Congress into taking the losses of big banks onto the public balance sheet, incurring $13 trillion of added debt. In effect, the Obama administration told the real economy to drop dead. The crisis became an opportunity to turn democracy into an oligarchy. The same thing happened in Ireland. After its banks made enormous insider loans, reckless loans and fraudulent loans, the government pledged to make the gamblers whole. The non-financial economy must now pay the bad bank debts because the European Central Bank, or the ECB, now rules the Eurozone economies. The ECB puts commercial banks first. That's just what central banks do. That's why the Federal Reserve Bank was made independent from the U.S. Treasury in 1913. They're there to promote bank interests, increasingly at odds with the rest of the economy. So now the banks have an absolute lock on the citizenry, because their precarious financial situation made them afraid to go on strike or even to complain about working conditions, because they fear fired at misapayment in their electric utility bill, the interest rate on their credit card jumps to 29%. And in America, if you miss a few mortgage payments, you can lose your home. So many workers fear that they are one paycheck away from being homeless. That's what the debt overhead has achieved for relations between labor and capital. The two-thirds of Americans who own their homes are afraid to complain and lose their job because this would threaten their economic solvency and hence their social status. Of course, all this will eventually impoverish the economy. But the big banks and bondholders hope to get out fast enough to take their money and run and repeat the process somewhere else. The problem, ultimately, is that which Alexander the Great faced. He cried when he felt there were no more worlds to conquer. So finance capital will end in tears. First for the debtors, then for the creditors themselves. The parasite will die with the host. That is what caused the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. The problem is that the Fed's act rescued the banks, not the economy. It kept the bad debts on the books instead of writing them down. The banks created a recklessly and unpayably high debt overhead that is subjecting the national economy to debt deflation as debtors try to pay by drastically reducing their consumption and tangible new investment. The opposite policy should be pursued. Mortgage debt should be written down to the ability to pay instead of the Federal Reserve and Treasury financing bank losses and bad gambles. Bondholders should lose, and only FDIC-insured depositors be rescued. But the financial sector simply uses its political clout to demand bailouts from the government, adding to public debt. The new credit given to the banks is sent abroad as banks jump ship. This is what happened to the U.S. Federal Reserve's $800 billion quantitative easing number two in 2011, and it's what will happen in 2012 under QE3. All right, ladies and gentlemen, here is my information. Your toll-free number remains the same at 888-874-4888. My email is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin, GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. My private number, my direct line, is 941 area code 441-1682. That's a number in Sarasota, which will take you straight through to Singapore. Again, 941-441-1682. All right, well, not this Sunday, but next Sunday coming up, the 30th of September, the Richard Martin Meetup Group will convene in New Brunswick, New Jersey, but at a new venue. I am happy to say the numbers of attendees have increased to the point that we need new premises. So, ladies and gentlemen, please note that we will be at 85 Somerset Street in the building of the Catholic Center at Rutgers University. Again, that's 85 Somerset Street. If you are coming by train, you have no streets to cross. Just exit the train and it's half a block away. And they're saying that a $2 donation is suggested per person to the center for the room. Well, this should be an exciting event, but Lou will be speaking. He'll be talking about his activities in Southeast Asia, which again were designed to find himself a place to live. I don't know whether he has made a final decision on that score yet, but you will find out on the 30th of September at 2 p.m. if you should care to wend your way thither. So Lou will be speaking, and Jack is our moderator, as always, and his number is 914-414-6940. That's Jack Chavesta, who would like you please to call him to indicate your desire to be present so that we can calculate the number of chairs we need and get everything ready. There will be a slideshow from Lou, who spent several months actually traveling around. He even visited Singapore for a few weeks, and we spent some time together while he was here. So do please decide that it would be in your best interests to spend an afternoon going to listen to Lou and enjoying the company of other people who are also seriously considering leaving the country and going to other climes to hang out during the coming depression. I got an email, by the way, from Lou, who wrote in to say that New Jersey motorists have another reason to frown about their driver's license photos. Apparently, the state has banned motorists from making big smiles for their photos because, wait for it, such expressions don't work with facial recognition software. How unfortunate. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Please listen to Lou on the 30th of September at 2 p.m. in New Brunswick. And by the way, the railroad station is equidistant between New York and Philadelphia, and there's plenty of parking for those who wish to come by car. In the meantime, it's time for our promos, so I shall take a little break, and so will you all, and we will be right back. We are back, and let us start with an email that just came through from Steve Kruger. I think it's something to do with the rooster, what we heard in the music. I don't know where it came from. I had not heard it before, but anyway, he has this to say. What a masterful touch, a crowing rooster. I thought I was hearing things. That happens with old ears. This sounds to me like the Singapore rooster protest. I've spent some of my younger years on a farm, and I am sad to say that the rooster wakes up at about 5 a.m. and has you beat for 3 extra hours of sleep. But then again, the rooster doesn't do the wake-up call. I think it's time to record the show. Steve Kruger. P.S. That rooster has a way with words. I get the message loud and clear. Very, very nice and profound, Steve. Thank you very much indeed. Right. Well, let me take another email from Al Berry, which also just this moment came in. He says, by the way, referring to what I think I said earlier on today, or it might have been last week, actually. Dear Richard, you said, the banking system is to all intents and purposes broke. Liabilities exceed assets by a significant margin, and but for the constant interventions of central banks, the equity of the U.S. major banks would be worthless. There is probably not a single one of them that is solvent. Is now the time to take money out of United States banks? Are all United States banks not safe? What would be a safe haven? Thank you, Al Berry. Al, if I've said this once, I've said it 1,000 times. Your absolute best, safest bet is to buy United States Treasury bills. It's really not rocket science. You know, if you keep your cash to below $250,000, you will be made whole by the FDIC. I'm sure Ben Bernanke will have it in his warm and generous heart to allow some of those trillions to go your way. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. But I do think that something which is safer than money under the mattress, just about anything else, is treasury bills. Because even if things started to unravel, in the unlikely event that money wouldn't be printed up, which could very well be the case, and I'm certain that there will be events which will overtake us that none of us can really think about today. But long before the treasury bills become unpaid, you will have the warning that things are really getting bad. Like, we've had warnings about municipalities not paying. We've had warnings that there are cities going bankrupt. We had warnings on the housing problem actually before it happened. There are plenty of things that will let us know that we need some more security in our lives. But right now, you will be okay. If you have extra money, put it into treasury bills or a treasury bill money market fund, but always being clear that T-bill money market funds may contain other things. So be very cautious about what's contained in those money market funds. Well, did you know that annual spending by the federal government now exceeds the 2007 level by about $1 trillion? Yes, annually, that is. But the slow economy has meant that revenues are little changed. The result is an unprecedented string of federal budget deficits, $1.4 trillion in 2009, 1.3 trillion in 2010, 1.3 trillion in 2011, and another 1.2 trillion on the way this year. The four-year increase in borrowing amounts to $55,000 per U.S. household. The Treasury pays off by servicing its debt in very short-term durations to take advantage of low short-term interest rates. It must frequently refinance this debt, which, when added to the current deficit, means the Treasury must raise $4 trillion this year alone. So the debt burden will explode when interest rates go up. The government has to get the money to finance its spending by taxing or borrowing. Just to remind you, the top 1% pay 37% of all income taxes, and 50% of the people pay none. That's income taxes, remember? During the last fiscal year, around three-quarters of the deficit was financed by the Federal Reserve. Foreign governments accounted for most of the rest, as American citizens and institutions' purchases and sales netted to about zero. The Fed now owns $1 in $6 of the national debt, the largest percentage of GDP in history, larger than even at the end of World War II. The Fed has effectively replaced the entire interbank money market and large segments of other markets with itself. It determines the interest rate by declaring what it will pay on reserve balances at the Fed without regard for the supply and demand of money. By replacing large, decentralized markets with centralized control by a few government officials, the Fed is distorting incentives and interfering with price discovery with unintended economic consequences. The Federal Reserve is now giving money to banks, effectively circumventing the appropriations process. To pay for quantitative easing, the purchase of government debt, mortgage-backed securities, etc., the Fed credits banks with electronic deposits that are reserve balances at the Federal Reserve. These reserve balances have exploded to $1.5 trillion from $8 billion in September 2008. The Fed now pays 0.25% interest on reserves it holds, which means it's paying the banks almost $4 billion a year. If interest rates rise to 2% and the Federal Reserve raises the rate it pays on reserves correspondingly, the payment rises to $30 billion a year. Would Congress appropriate that kind of money to give? Remember, not lend to banks. The Fed's Operation Twist, buying long-term and selling short-term debt, is substituting for the Treasury's traditional debt management. All this is creating a massive increase of reserves at the Fed. The Fed has simply no idea what to do with all the monster they have created in the form of all this money. Ladies and gentlemen, I say this to you in all seriousness. The country is on the absolute verge of passing an economic, fiscal, and financial point of no return. The problems are close to being unmanageable as it is now. Staying on the current path will mean that these problems will wind up being completely unmanageable, culminating in a terrible financial explosion and crisis. There is no alternative. All right, let's take a couple more emails. One from Masood, who writes in, who is Japan's creditor? And Germany is right behind the U.S., yet they are so happy. Two ranks below is China, and they aren't worried either. On some shows, you've mentioned that Korea is a pretty good place to emigrate to, but it is right below France. The only two countries looking good are Russia and India. Thanks, Masood. Well, Masood, You know, I don't think that the fact that a country like Korea is in trouble financially should really play into the problems of whether it is a good place to immigrate to or not. They have an excellent internal economy, and they have really no immediate chance of defaulting. So I think that if you're looking for a good life at very inexpensive prices and a place where they speak a lot of English, Korea really is a good place to go to. You can ask our correspondent who spoke at the meetup group a few weeks ago. He's been there over 20 years and he seems to think it's a really good place to go. And he came back to the United States, to Connecticut, and was pretty despondent with what he found. So I think Korea is really not a bad pick. You know, Japan's creditor clearly is China, of course, China and Japan are having internal squabbles about some tiny little islands which do yield plenty of oil and gas over their ocean territory, but nevertheless, Germany, of course, is right behind the U.S., as you say, but the thing about Germany is that they don't understand is that if the European Union collapses, then Germany will collapse too, because they have made so many loans to these countries, particularly the southern European countries. So that's why Germany has problems with Greece and Spain hiving off and floating out into the Mediterranean alone. And why Germany itself would have a problem if it went back to the Deutschmark. They have too many debts that they have put out there as creditors in euros, and there's no telling what would happen to those, but it would be a very, very serious situation for Germany indeed. So that's Germany's problem. Okay, so thank you for the email. John Dusmanis wrote in saying, "Hi, Richard. When we had TARP, the program took back hundreds of billions of bad mortgage-backed securities from investors. Had this not been done, these investors would have taken legal action in American courts charging fraud. A lot may have filed under the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organization Act. A loss under this law requires triple damages to be paid. TARP was a way for the taxpayers to make restitution to those swindled by the banks rather than the banks making good. QE3, where the Fed buys mortgage-backed securities, is another way of hiding the fact that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have most likely been asked to take back hundreds of billions of worthless securities sold during bubble years. This would not be possible because taxpayers would go crazy now that government owns these corporations. Present liabilities taken on by taxpayers are huge. To ask taxpayers to make good on past bad securities may start a revolt. This is my personal opinion as to why this program was started. John." Absolutely, John. Completely correct. It is a brazen, pretty undisguised effort to save Freddie and Fannie. And anybody who knows the slightest thing about QE3 concept will agree with me, and you, for that matter. So thank you very much for that. It was an interesting explanation and absolutely on the ball. All right, so that was John, and, I did myself the favor of printing out John's email twice, so I won't read it out again, because I don't think that, unlike Bernanke, who does things two or three times, hoping for a different result, I think the result of my reading out an email twice would be the same, so I won't do it. All right, I have to say that there is no sign that the Eurozone will emerge from crisis anytime soon. Markets, that's market spelled M-A-R-K-I-T, which is the Financial Services Information Company, reports that the Eurozone is seeing its steepest declines in the Eurozone since June 2009. their index signaled that the private sector economy contracted for the 12th time in the past 13 months, with the rate of decline accelerating slightly to reach the fastest since June 2009. The September reading rounds of the weakest quarter since the second quarter of 2009. Manufacturing and services saw similarly steep rates of decline in September. However, while manufacturing output fell at the slowest rate since April, the service sector saw the largest drop in activity since July 2009. The faster rate of decline in output reflected an accelerated rate of loss of new business, the largest monthly fall since May 2009. France saw output and new orders both fall at the fastest rates since April 2009, with rates of decline accelerating markedly in both manufacturing and services. Employment fell for the ninth consecutive month across the Eurozone, dropping at the fastest rate since January 2010. The rate of job losses in services was the highest since November 2009 and steeper than the cut seen in manufacturing, which was the lowest for 5 months. While only a marginal fall in employment was seen in Germany, French payroll numbers were cut at the fastest rate since November 2009. And elsewhere across the region, employment showed the largest monthly fall since July 2009. Things are deteriorating rapidly. More austerity is coming to Spain and Italy. France is hiking taxes and fees like crazy, as well as considering plans to prohibit businesses from firing employees. And economists are expecting or hoping interest rate cuts will inspire confidence. Not only are such economists unable to think, they cannot even see what 20 years of monetary and fiscal stimulus did to Japanese confidence, which is to say nothing at all. However, lower interest rates and fiscal stimulus did leave Japan a mountain of debt in its wake. Japan is now hooked on low interest rates. A mere rise of 1 percentage point would consume all of their revenues. Is that supposed to inspire confidence? Nonetheless, Bernanke and Draghi have vowed to keep doing what they're doing until it works. And economists are hoping it will. Ladies and gentlemen, it's pure insanity. Well, another email from Bill Sheehan, who says, Richard, thanks for the excellent emails and, of course, for the show. My question is about money market funds. What is the difference between any old market fund versus a T-bill-based fund? I presume that T-bill funds invest in T-bills, but are ordinary funds invested in derivatives? How do they generate returns, and what are the risks for each? Thanks so much, Bill. Well, normally, Bill, I wouldn't go for this because actually, you know, I have talked about it before, but I think it's important, especially since an earlier email where it was clear that the writer was not too clear in his own mind about what T-bill funds are. First of all, Treasury bills are the shortest maturity of the United States government. They are 180 days maximum maturity. So you can't really go wrong whether interest rates go up or down. Basically, you will make money, or rather, you will not lose money if you have Treasury bills, because they will simply mature at pretty much the same rate as you bought them. So that's not an issue. Now, they have introduced Treasury bill money market funds, which simply allow you to buy a fund at $1 parity rate for a Treasury bill exposure, which is supposed to keep only Treasury bills in those funds. Of course, sometimes they put other things unobtrusively, so you need to be very careful when you buy such a fund that you only do have Treasury bills within them. Basically, the average fund which is not a T-bill fund, will have commercial paper, and things which are very, very exposed to the economy when things go bad, when companies go under, their commercial paper will go under, and such funds risk what they call breaking the buck, which means being traded at less than $1 a share, because as you probably know or need to know, all money market funds are traded at $1 a share, and you simply receive a payout based on that $1 a share price. So the share price never moves, you just receive money based on that share price. So they are invested in various different things. Each money market fund comes with a prospectus so that you can see exactly what is contained within those funds. When it comes to Treasury bill money market funds, I strongly recommend that you do actually look in to see what is inside those funds, because otherwise you could get some bad surprises. But I hope I've answered your question there, Bill, and good luck, and do remember to make sure that you have Treasury bill money market funds. Okay, I had an email from David Gray, and David Gray writes in saying, "Dear Richard, I have just started listening to you. It seems that the search for useful, that being contraries, well-researched, not property of the propaganda machine that has made my TV a useless device for the news of the advertising plus content of entertainment, is a sophisticated illusion believed as gospel by too many people. Those of us that never studied economics and as of the GFC decided to rectify this gaping ignorance, the illusion of the separate reality pushed upon us, cracked and fell to dust at a speed that my physics education told me was impossible. That day being 9/11, and from that point many separate strands of history tied together, and from this mass murder, so many wars and creeping security. Fascist state emerges. Living here in Australia, I see how a population can be turned to sports and drug-addicted majority who cannot see the signs of a falling economy. Real estate in turning down 7% this past 9 months, prices rising, shops closing, and our citizens with $1 trillion in personal debt. The banks, 44-1 leverage, our balance of payments kept afloat by mining. Question. QE2 infinity, the time of the GFC inclined me to buy gold and silver and has been an excellent investment so far. My thinking is printing cash will make it cash worthless, and that the idea of producing worthless money is to destroy all fiat currency. Bernanke has now opened the floodgates. So to have the EU and others taking this course, you predicted the quadrillions in derivatives and other debt is a way these billions come as small change. Am I wrong to not trust the government with my money? Should I sell out? I had thought that having real money may allow me to buy a discounted home in a few years as Australia and the world's banks collapse, and collapse it will. How can I have faith in any paper money? Great show. If it were not for the internet, where would we be now? The security state. They crashed my Facebook page for blowing a secret." Sorry to hear that, David. Yes, obviously you mentioned problems in Australia. Yes, there are problems, and they have been predicted by many people for a long time. Canada, I fear, is next. I fear that the Canadian real estate market is about to blow hard, and you need to be extremely cautious about that as well. But, you know, in a time when things go bad, generally that time is met with a deflationary characteristic. That's to say, everything falls in value, and the one thing that retains its value is money. So don't be misled by people who tell you that we are headed for inflation, that you must not hold money, you must hold things, because that is the trap. That's the big trap that everybody is going to fall into. They will buy themselves all kinds of assets in the mistaken impression that their money is going to lose value. That, ladies and gentlemen, was what you needed to do years ago. It's what would have been good advice at the beginning of the inflationary period. Buy yourself the assets that will appreciate during the inflation and get rid of money. I remember saying the same thing myself. I said it over and over again. I said it to everybody in terms of everything that they bought, that they were doing the right thing. Mind you, if they had bought the right thing, of course, some things didn't work out. But in general, you could pretty much buy anything. It would increase in value, and then you could cash out and have a lot more money at the end of the day. Now, it's the opposite extreme. We are in deflation. Therefore, you cannot own things. You must own money and money equivalents, because that's what will gain value. You can talk to anybody who was alive at the time in the 30s of deflation that will tell you that that is true. And their sons and daughters, who are probably, in the case of some of the older ones among you, your parents, will have told you that you must hold on to things, that you must save money, that you must not spend money, you must save it. And of course, that was completely the wrong advice. The advice would have been to spend that money on things. And now the people who spend money on things are telling you, yes, go ahead, spend money on things. Just like the parents, that is now the wrong advice. The advice you need to hear is hold money and money equivalents. The value of things will drop against that money. You know, so, you know, we don't have much time, in fact, any time, I think, now to go into this in any more detail. But do understand, advice has to change with the change in trend. The change in the great long wave will change, and that must therefore change your outlook. And so we will talk about this later on at a later stage. But in any case, we have come to the end of another show, ladies and gentlemen, so I am going to wish you well and a wonderful week, and I will talk to you again on Friday. Take care. This is Richard Martin saying bye-bye till then.